Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 88389, Public Employees Retirement System of Ohio versus June Betts. Mr. Sutter, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case presents the following issue. Must age-based distinctions in benefits offered through a bona fide employee benefit plan be justified by age-related cost considerations? The Sixth Circuit answered that question in the affirmative. The Public Employees Retirement System of Ohio, however, disputes that holding and believes that an age-related cost justification is inconsistent with the plain language of the Age Discrimination and Employment Act and, moreover, is inconsistent with the purposes of the ADEA and, in particular, Section 4F2 of the Act. The facts are as follows. The Public Employees Retirement System of Ohio, which I will refer to as PERS, was created by the Ohio General Assembly in 1933. It provides retirement benefits to Ohio public employees on the municipal, county, and state level. There are two types of retirement benefits available: age and service retirement benefits and disability retirement benefits. There are three ways to qualify for age and service retirement benefits. A member of PERS must have at least 5 years of service credit, have attained the age of 60, or must have at least 25 years of service credit and be at least 55 years of age, or must have 30 years of service credit irrespective of age. In order to qualify for disability retirement benefits, a member of PERS must have at least 5 years of service credit, have not attained the age of 60, and be or presumed to be permanently disabled. The actuarial assumptions that underlie both the disability retirement benefits and the age and service retirement benefits are intertwined, and all benefits, whether they be age and service or disability retirement benefits, are derived from a common fund. June Betts, the appellee, was hired by the Hamilton County Board of Mental Retardation and Developmental Disabilities at the age of 55. At the age of 61, she became disabled because of health. She submitted applications both for disability retirement benefits and age and service retirement benefits to PERS. She requested that her age and service retirement application not be processed unless her disability retirement application could not be processed. June Betts was more interested in the disability retirement benefits because they would have afforded her a higher monthly pension. Because Ohio law contains an age 60 cutoff for eligibility to apply for disability retirement benefits, PERS could not process her disability retirement application. They did, however, process and approve her age and service application. She is currently receiving a monthly pension as well as full health care. June Betts initiated suit claiming that the age 60 cutoff under Ohio law for eligibility to apply for disability retirement benefits constituted a violation of the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. PERS defended on the basis that its plan was protected under Section 4F2 of the Act, which provides that it will not be illegal for an employer to observe the terms of any bona fide employee benefit plan, such as a retirement pension or insurance plan, which is not a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act, provided no such plan permits or requires involuntary retirement because of age. The District Court granted June Betts' motion for summary judgment on two bases. First, the Court held that PERS was not the type of plan contemplated under 4F2 because the age 60 cutoff could not be justified by age-related cost considerations. Secondly, the District Court found that the unavailability of disability retirement benefits to June Betts was the equivalent of constructive discharge and involuntary retirement because of age. Thus, a divided panel of the Sixth Circuit affirmed on the basis that the age 60 cutoff under PERS could not be justified by an age-related cost consideration. It did not, however, reach the constructive discharge or the involuntary retirement question. Now, PERS asserts that the Sixth Circuit was incorrect in its holding that 4F2 requires a showing of age-related cost for three reasons.
What precise language in 4F2 are you relying on, Mr. Sutter?
Mr. Chief Justice, we are relying on the language that says quite clearly any bona fide employee benefit plan, such as a retirement, pension, or insurance plan, which is not a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act. The language clearly does not contain an age-related cost justification.
But then how about the proviso that comes afterwards?
In respect to involuntary retirement, Your Honor? Or the subterfuge language.
Well, where it says, and no such employee benefit plan shall require or permit the involved, et cetera, et cetera. Does that not have a bearing on it?
Your Honor, the Sixth Circuit did not reach the question of involuntary retirement. However, the concept, the notion that because June Betts was ineligible to apply for a particular benefit, that she was involuntarily retired because of her age is just not applicable here. It was her health that required June Betts, that in fact motivated June Betts to apply to retire. She wanted to retire. The only question is, what kind of retirement benefit was she going to receive?
So you say all we have before us is whether or not PERS has a bona fide employee benefit plan, such as a retirement pension or insurance plan?
Which is not a subterfuge to
which
evade
is not
the purpose
a subterfuge to evade the purpose of this change.
Yes, Your Honor. The Sixth Circuit did not address the other question. The other two reasons, besides the fact
Potter,
that... Yes, Justice O'Connor.
May I ask about the operation of this plan? I take it the benefits were the same for voluntary retirement or for disability up until 1976, was it?
In 1976, the Ohio General Assembly instituted a minimum benefit under disability retirement benefits, a 30%
They were
minimum.
The same until then. And then in 1976, there was a 30% increase in disability benefits. Is
well,
that right?
Not a 30% increase. What the Ohio General Assembly did was they instituted a provision so that the disability retirement would receive no less than 30% of his or her final average salary.
Well, this discrepancy arose by action in 76?
That is correct.
And that was post-act action?
It was post-act action. However, Your Honor, it distinguished between disability and disability retirements and age and service retirements. It did not distinguish specifically on the basis of age. The Ohio General Assembly made a decision to increase the benefits that would be available, a minimum benefit, to disability retirements, but it wasn't on the basis of age. It affects all disability retirements and all age and service retirements, the same irrespective of age. So it is PERS's contention that that particular amendment to Ohio law did not remove it from the pre-existing plan status.
Well, it seems to me that it could be viewed as an attempt to use a pre-act plan as a subterfuge.
Your Honor, the only sort of impact that the provision would have in respect to age is that it could have had a residual impact because, as you've noted, prior to 1976, the benefit was calculated the same. But the provision itself is neutral on its face and was intended to enhance the benefits of disability retirements. Now, if the court is approaching this from the position that there was some sort of disparate impact, if we assume that under the ADEA that there is a disparate impact cause of action, and I am aware that there is some dispute in that respect, the point would still be that June Betts would have been obligated to introduce evidence, statistical data, to demonstrate that there was a disparate impact on older workers because of this 30% minimum. In any event, the provision is age neutral. And so it did not discriminate against older workers, and therefore, whether PERS is a pre-act plan.
The plan viewed as a whole isn't age neutral, is it?
Your Honor, that particular provision was,
You're
and
just
therefore.
You're saying the addition in 1976 was. But if
that
you
is
look,
correct.
If you look at the whole plan as amended, it's difficult to see how it's age neutral.
But we're not suggesting that the whole plan is age neutral. First, PERS would assert that it's a pre-existing plan, that all the provisions that discriminated on the basis of age, i.e. the age 60 cutoff, was in the plan well before the ADEA was passed, let alone made applicable to the states. Moreover,
well, you can't just make any subsequent changes with impunity, can you?
No, Your Honor.
Do we have to look at the subsequent changes and their effect to see if it's a subterfuge?
Your Honor, PERS's assertion is that under 4F2, one must look to see whether the plan as a whole serves as a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act. The question here is, does the PERS plan as a whole serve to frustrate the employment of older workers or discriminate against them in respect to wages, or other terms of compensation or incidentals that aren't associated with employee benefit plans. PERS is suggesting that in order to determine whether the plan is a subterfuge, that one must look at how the plan as a whole operates. And PERS's plan operates on the whole as a retirement plan. It was created to offer retirement benefits to various individuals who, after they could no longer work or chose to no longer work for the state of Ohio, might have a retirement benefit available to them. But the plan was not established. It was not created for the purpose of driving older workers from the workforce or interfering with their hiring. The very fact that June Betts was hired at the age of 55 and would have been permitted, would have been entitled to remain at her job, irrespective of her age, except for her health, indicates that the plan did not have the effect of driving this person from the job market.
But as you look at it in its effect now, as amended, it appears to be facially discriminatory.
Yes, Your Honor, the fact that the age 60 cutoff was there made it facially discriminatory. And there's never been an assertion by PERS that there isn't discrimination in not permitting people age 60 or older to apply. PERS's defense is that under the 4F2 exemption, that sort of discrimination is permissible. That as long as the terms of the plan are observed, as long as the purpose of the plan is to provide an employee benefit, as long as the plan isn't designed to frustrate the employment of older workers or to discriminate and respect the compensation that they would receive outside of an employee benefit plan, that PERS is bona fide. I mean, PERS is a retirement system. There's no other purpose behind it. It exists. I mean, it pays substantial benefits.
Well, all retirement plans are discriminatory on the basis of age, aren't they?
That is correct, Your Honor. The age-related cost consideration creates an obstacle for employers.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals didn't say this was a subterfuge, did they?
No, Your Honor.
They went on the cost differences.
Yes. One of the interesting things about the age-related cost justification is the courts below can't seem to agree what portion of the exemption provides the statutory justification. And one might suggest that the type of plan argument was a development to circumvent this court's holding in McMahon versus United Airlines, or United Airlines versus McMahon, because of the subterfuge.
What do the so-called guidelines rely on in requiring this cost justification? Do they identify the language of the act they're construing?
No, Your Honor, they don't. They don't point to any language. The appellee and the amicus, the Solicitor General's office, would argue that, and they use their terms, they say both the such as language and the subterfuge language can be read to accommodate the age-related cost justification. But it's such a clear statute. It just says any bona fide employee benefit plan, such as a retirement, pension, or insurance plan. Congress had an opportunity to include an age-related cost justification. They could have said what they were trying to get at in a much more direct fashion.
Well, it may be, but isn't it an argument that it's a subterfuge if there isn't an age cost justification?
First, Your Honor, I would point the court.
At least it's an argument, isn't it?
That's the argument posed. The question is it reasonable in light of the language of the statute? There's nothing on the face of the statute that qualifies the protection or the coverage of the exemption to a plan that can demonstrate that the differences in benefits offered to older and younger workers is a result of age-related cost.
Well, what evidence other than cost justification would ever be relevant in determining or proving that a facially discriminatory plan is not a subterfuge?
I think, Your Honor, that the evidence that a court would have to scrutinize is whether the plan as a whole is intended to evade the purposes of the Act. So one has to look into the intent. One of the problems with the age-related cost justification is it takes a test that requires an inquiry into the motivation of the employer and requires the employer to satisfy an objective rule. If you can't demonstrate age-related cost justification, then ipso facto, you are a subterfuge, no matter what the intent of the employer. And the age-related cost justification is not present in the language. The language that Congress.
What would the employer intend or point to other than cost justifications?
I think what the court would require an employer to demonstrate is that his plan is not conceived with the intention of frustrating the employment of older workers. For instance, if the plan made it difficult for an employer, an older worker, to be hired, or if it made it difficult for an older worker to advance within the employ of that particular company, specifically because of that person's age, or if they tried to use the plan to reduce the wages or salaries of older workers, that would mean it was a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act. I think a good example might be in the Carlin case out of the Seventh Circuit. Now, that court did find an age, did rely on an age-related cost justification. But they found that the plan itself was bona fide. They just found that the plan may have been conceived with the purpose of forcing older workers from the job market. That's the sort of inquiry that the court would engage in. And the cost justification, which I think this court at least rejected in respect to pre-existing plans in the McMahon decision, and that I think Justice White's concurrence specifically rejects, if there is no economic or business purpose necessary, and age-related cost is certainly a type of economic or business purpose, it too would be the improper test.
Isn't there some indication that Congress intended to overrule part of our McMahon decision?
Your Honor, Congress did overrule part of the McMahon decision. It reversed this court in respect to its holding that involuntary retirement based on age was legal within the 402 exemption. But the language passed by Congress says specifically that it addresses itself exclusively to the issue of involuntary retirement. There's nothing in the language of the 78 Amendment to suggest that Congress was addressing anything other than the McMahon position on involuntary retirement. Now, the appellee may point to some language in the legislative history, but first, that legislative history, I think, does as much to confirm that what Congress was concerned about was the issue of involuntary retirement, and admonishing the courts that whether that involuntary retirement provision came in before or after the passage of the ADA made no difference. There was going to be a complete restriction in respect to involuntary retirement on the basis of age. But because the amendment in 1978 dealt only with the issue of involuntary retirement, any remarks in the legislative history involving what the 67 Amendment meant, or what the 67 Act meant, is irrelevant. You can't look to an older Congress, or this Court has not looked to a Congress 10 years later, to divine the meaning of legislation passed in 1967. Moreover, in the appellee's brief and the amicus brief, they now contend that the 1967 Act had more than one purpose. In effect, they're saying there were at least two purposes underlying the 402 exemption. Well, the remarks in the 78 legislative history that they refer to mention only age-related costs. It seems to me inherent in that position is that the people in the Congress in 78, even they were misconstruing the scope of the 402 exemption. Now, I think as the Court is aware, that there are two portions that the courts below try to plug this age-related cost consideration in, the such-as language and the subterfuge language. Now, I've discussed at some length why it shouldn't fit in the subterfuge language. I'd like to address why it can't fit into the such-as a retirement pension or insurance plan language. The basic reason is that age-related cost is not the common thread that binds pension, retirement, and insurance plans. In 1967, when the ADEA was promulgated, and even today, there are plans such as PERS's plan, such as defined contribution pension plans, or a profit-sharing pension plan that cannot reflect age-related cost. And when Congress passed this legislation, these were common types of retirement plans. They could have limited the scope of this exemption if they wanted to, but they picked very broad language. They said any bona fide employee benefit plan, such as a retirement pension and insurance plan. But that was to emphasize the point that employers could not discriminate in respect to salary or wages or incidentals associated to coming to work and putting in a day's work for a day's pay. So The common thread between retirement pension and insurance plans, however, is the fact that they do provide compensation of a kind outside of wages and salary. Moreover, common sorts of aspects or benefits within a particular plan, for instance, in a defined benefit plan, there is no age-related cost justification for a set-off for Social Security. There is no increase for an employer to provide benefits just because the Social Security is also providing benefits, but that sort of provision would be illegal because it can't be justified by an age-related cost consideration. Now, I think I've touched at length the fact that the language doesn't support the legislative history. I'd like to point out that and reinforce that at the time that Congress passed this legislation, and even today, there's a fairly common understanding of what an employee benefit plan is. In fact, it's remarkable how legislation throughout the years has reflected a similarity in what industry, what Congress recognizes an employee benefit plan. And so these sorts of plans, just like PERS, was no stranger to Congress at the time they passed the legislation. And I'd also like to point out that in Justice White's concurrence in United Airlines versus McMahon, Justice White enunciated the very same policy that we are enunciating here. I think it's also consistent.
How many votes did that get?
It got one vote, but I thought it was a very good vote. I think also that the McMahon majority inherently reflected that position when they said explicitly that a pre-existing plan didn't have to show an age-related cost justification because it didn't have to show a business or economic purpose. And the court concludes, and whether one wants to consider a dicta or not, a majority of this bench still concluded that opinion by saying without qualification that an economic or business purpose is not necessary to demonstrate that the employer falls within the perimeters of the Section 4F2 exemption. Now, much of the Appellee's case rests on this court taking legislative history and trying to cram it in someplace to the 4F2 exemption. And they contend that it's very clear in the 1967 legislative history that all Congress was talking about was age-related cost. Well, one of the most principal pieces of legislative history in regard to the ADEA is the Secretary of Labor's report that this court noted in EEOC versus Wyoming provided a great deal of guidance to Congress. And the Secretary of Labor provided more than just cost justification. In fact, the Secretary of Labor noted that that wasn't the principal hindrance. What the legislative history demonstrates is that 4F2 was a vital compromise. It represented a vital piece of the package in order to get the Age Discrimination and Employment Act passed. Congress wanted to ensure that older workers would be hired. They wanted to promote that. That was the consuming purpose of the ADEA. And the consuming purpose of the 4F2 exemption was to protect employee benefit plans, which might serve as hindrances to the hiring of older workers, was to protect them from disruption. And the age-related cost justification certainly does disrupt bona fide plans. I would direct the court toward the amicus brief submitted by the state of Pennsylvania, pages 29 and 30, in which Pennsylvania notes that at least 10 other states deny disability retirement benefits to people who are eligible for age and service retirement. And they make reference to 25 other states that have plans that have some sort of distinction based on age and respect to disability retirement benefits. I would also direct the court to the amicus brief submitted by the Association of Private Pension and Welfare Plans, and direct the court to page 24, where they indicate that the majority of retirement plans, just like the plan at issue here, apparently limit eligibility for disability benefits to those younger employees who are ineligible for regular or early retirement benefits. So if Congress was trying to avoid the disruption of these employee benefit plans in order to ensure that employers would hire older workers, then the age-related cost considerations does an injustice to that. The last point that I would like to make, moving on from the legislative history, is that The amicus, the EEOC, and the person of the general, the Solicitor General's office, will argue to this court that they should adopt the age-related cost consideration because it's reflective of consistent agency policy. Well, I would and agency interpretation. I would just like to make note for the court that when this legislation was first, when the EEOC or the Department of Labor regulations were first published in 1969, they initially had one safe harbor. Then later in 69, they created two safe harbors. When the EEOC republished and revamped the regulations involving Section 4F2, they went back to one purpose and one way to satisfy the exemption. And now again, in this appeal, for the first time in this litigation, they argue that there were really two purposes. Well, I don't see that sort of flip-flop as being consistent agency interpretation. If anything, it indicates that the agency has been inconsistent. And unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Sutter. Mr. Laufman?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. When June Betts was disabled at age 61, she was denied disability benefits by PRS solely because of her age. And she was then forced to retire to apply for regular retirement rather than disability retirement. But for the PRS age 60 rule in the PRS plan, June Betts would have received $355 under disability benefits instead of the $158.50 per month that she received. Now, it's undisputed that the PRS plan discriminates on the basis of age and would be in violation of the Act unless it is eligible for the 4F2 exemption to the Act. PRS has two arguments. The first of these arguments is that all pre-1967 plans are exempt in perpetuity. The second of these issues is that there's no requirement that employee benefit plans that discriminate on the basis of age must be justified by cost considerations. I will focus primarily on the first issue, and Mr. Wright, on behalf of the United States, will be focusing and addressing the second issue. Turning to the first issue, as has been noted, this is not a pre-AD Act plan, that in 1976 there were modifications. The lower courts are unanimous in holding that where there are substantial and relevant modifications to an employee benefit plan, that it loses its status as a pre-act plan.
Was this point passed on by the Court of Appeals, Mr. Laufman?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals did not address this issue because it ruled that Congress had overturned McMahon, and therefore it was unnecessary to reach that particular issue.
So you're arguing this is an alternative basis for affirmance.
That is correct. We have also argued that the so-called McMahon issue is no longer viable.
May I ask on your point that it was a new plan when they amended it, the age 60 cutoff for disability benefits was in the plan from the start, wasn't it?
It was in the plan from the start, but when you take the age 60 and the only putting in a 30% floor for disability because it denies employees who become disabled after age 60, it discriminates between employees who are disabled before age 60 and employees who are disabled after age 60.
That discrimination, although not as dramatic, was in the plan before, though.
That's correct.
And was it also true that the discrimination between pre-60 and post-60 people?
That's correct.
Was it also true before the change that disability retirees received a larger benefit than a person with the amount of seniority that your client had?
With the same amount of seniority, an employee who was disabled at the age of 59 would receive a 30%. An employee who was disabled at age 25 would receive 75% for life. And this is totally different than many of the plans that most people are familiar with.
Well, wait a minute. I just want to be sure I understand. Right before the 76 amendment, if your client had the same age and the same seniority that she did have when she retired, if she had done that in 1976, would she have, but the same discrimination have been present? And as would she have made more by getting the disability pension than the retirement pension?
I think I understand the question, but basically...
Well, the question is now she gets she would have gotten $350, she gets about $169.
Right. If you look at it before 1976,
yeah.
she would have received approximately the same income under either plan.
I see. The disability, the increase to a 30% of salary was so great that before, I mean, there would have been no difference.
That's correct. Because of the way the regular retirement is calculated, the 30% floor only affects employees with more than 5 years and less than 15 years, 13 to 17 years, and only those in that small group, only those who become disabled after age 60. So we're dealing with a very, very small group of people. And the total dollar effect that taking away this age 60 requirement would have would be like dropping a pebble in a pond. It's our position that the changes in 1967 caused PRS to lose any pre-act exemption that it might have had. Now, we don't agree that there is any such thing as a pre-act exemption anymore. We believe that that's limited to involuntary retirement systems, and we believe that it's clearly no longer the law following 1978. According to the...
If we agreed with your submission that because of the amendment, this is not a pre-act plan, we wouldn't have to deal with the question of whether the 78 amendment is limited, as your opponent suggests, or more broad, as you suggest.
That is absolutely correct.
But we would have to deal with the question in the future as to how much of an amendment is too much.
That is correct also.
Have some suggestion as to how we would answer that in the future?
I think it's going to depend.
Or how the people who run these plans are going to figure it out before they go making any amendments?
You're talking about the amendments to the plans, right. Not the amendment to the statute.
Right, plans. I mean, I assume it. If we were to come out the way you want us to, it would be a big problem for anyone who is contemplating a change in a plan that currently qualifies for the McMahon exemption.
That's correct. And the lower courts are unanimous in holding that when you make substantial and relevant changes, and I submit that the test for substantial and relevant is going to be the same kind of a test that the courts are used to applying all the time. If they change some things such as allowing the police officers to buy one year of extra time or buy service credit, probably would not be significant and relevant. But when you start changing things that directly affect impact on the age discrimination factor, then I submit that it is a significant and relevant factor, and clearly is in this case. The approach that PRS takes, that pre-existing plans are exempt, in effect is saying that Congress granted them a perpetual exemption, a perpetual right to continue to violate the law until somehow Congress says we were wrong and changes the law. What they've done is created two classes. You have a pre- 1967 class and a post 1967 class. The pre-act are free to discriminate at will.
The 8 amendments does then that just destroys the argument that that because it's an old plan, it's not a subterfuge.
That's correct.
Well, but you'd still have to show it's a subterfuge.
You'd still have to show it.
And then you'd do that on the cost-benefit basis?
You do that on the cost-benefit basis.
Uh-huh. So you have to get to that eventually.
And I submit that that's there's a basis for that. It's important to note, I think, that this 4F2 is an exception to a remedial statute. And it's our position that this should be interpreted narrowly. Now, the burden... And in Thurston, this Court has said that that's an affirmative defense. And so the burden is on PRS to show that it qualifies. Now, it has the burden of proving that there is no subterfuge.
Is this the language you rely on in the 4F2, there has to be a cost justification? Otherwise, it's a subterfuge.
There's two different ways of approaching the cost justification. That's correct.
But that's one of them.
That's one of them. The employer having the burden of proving something is not a subterfuge is a very difficult task of proving a negative, especially where you have a state legislature in Ohio which keeps no legislative history, so that it's almost impossible to determine what the intent was when they amended or passed an act.
I don't know. All he has to do is convince a court that it's just contrary to the words of the act to require a cost benefit.
Well, that is
a cost justification.
That is precisely why the the EEOC regulations, which provide...
Aren't these just guidelines?
They are just guidelines. They call them interpretations. We submit that this court should give it some deference because they have been consistent over the years. They've been in effect 20 years, and in the whole, the employers in this country have been adhering to those regulations.
Have they changed?
The regulations have changed, but they have been totally consistent. In 1969, the regulations came out with what amounted to an equal cost, equal benefit approach. That is, if the plan paid equal benefits, there was no discrimination. On the other hand, if the plan cost the same amount, even though it provided smaller benefits, there was no discrimination. And the example that are given in the EEOC regs is that it's perfectly all right for an employer to pay $100 for life insurance for all of its employees. And if it turns out that the younger employee gets twice as much life insurance, while that might have been a violation of the Act, it's permitted under the 4F2 exemption.
Mr. Laufman, what the appellant says to that, and I think the language seems to me to support him, is that those regulations were safe harbors. They were offering the person who wanted to set up plans one way to be perfectly safe and to know that that it could not possibly be held to be a subterfuge, but that didn't set forth a requirement in order to get the exemption. It was just a safe harbor.
That's true.
If you did this, you could get it for sure, but there may be other ways of getting it.
That's true.
Well, if that's so, then...
But at this point, and I think it's important to note that PRS produced absolutely no evidence of any kind of a justification. Their entire approach was, we existed, therefore we are. That because of their existence, they don't have to do anything. They have produced absolutely no evidence of any kind of a justification. So if there are other types, no one has come forward with another type. The EEOC regulations have been in effect for years. They have been consistent, and they provide an objective way of meeting a very complex problem. There are a multitude of employee benefit plans, and even within retirement plans, there are profit-sharing plans, there are defined benefit plans, and there are variations.
Under the EEOC regulations, if you can produce a cost justification, does that take out the question of intent?
Well, I don't think we really get into intent. The intent is to discriminate, and that has already been established. The question then is whether or not it's a subterfuge, and if they can produce cost-based justifications, then they have dispelled the argument that there's a subterfuge.
So you couldn't go behind the cost justification and say, well, really, at a conference committee in the Ohio legislature, someone said, let's pass this because we don't like old people.
That's correct. That's correct.
May I ask, Mr. Laufman, does everyone agree, I mean, I guess they must, that the burden of proof on the subterfuge issue is on the proponent of the plan rather than the person who claims it's a subterfuge?
I believe this Court said that in Thurston that the Section 4F1 and 4F2 are affirmative defenses and that the burden would always be on the defendant.
Well, it could still be an affirmative defense to show that it's a bona fide seniority system. And then, say, the president of the company gets on the stand and says, it's not a subterfuge. We didn't adopt it for any age-related reason. We like old people. And then the burden shifts.
Well, I think you're...
What I'm really asking, I suppose, is assuming the cost is an issue, who has to get into proving costs or non-costs?
In our position and in the regulation position, it's the employers, because they're the only one who have the evidence of cost considerations. They're the ones that...
You just a moment ago said that it's only going to cost them a penny to... I mean, that there's... You said in this case it's perfectly obvious that there's no cost defense. You said that earlier.
I said that there's no cost defense because they made no effort to put on any evidence.
Oh, I thought you indicated that there really wasn't any cost here, that because the 60 age thing was perfectly obviously an arbitrary.
I'm sorry?
I thought you... I may have misunderstood you. I thought earlier in the argument you had said that it was perfectly obvious that it would cost them a penny or something like that to remove the age 60 cut.
Oh, I think what I was referring to is that the impact on this plan, on the PS plan, is that if this Court ruled that the plan was in violation of the Act, there are so few employees who fit into this very narrow window where it has any effect, that the 50 to 100 employees that would be added to a plan that pays something like $400 million a year in benefits would be insignificant. That was the point I was making.
The court below said this wasn't a subterfuge, didn't they?
The court below essentially quoted Judge Posner in Carlin, who said that where an employer cannot produce actuarial costs to justify age discrimination in employee benefits, he'd better be able to prove a close correlation between age and cost if he wants the shelter of the safe harbor of Section 4F2.
And is that equivalent to saying without cost it's a subterfuge, or no?
That is, I believe, is the,
is that what the court
is
of
the
appeals
position that
say?
The court has taken, yes. I'd like to point out that PRS says that essentially that all employee benefit plans are covered. Essentially, they're throwing out all of the EEOC regulations that have been in effect for 20 years, and in particular, the regulation that has been in effect for 10 years pertaining to disability plans, which PRS clearly violates. The disability section of the reg says that where employees who are disabled at a younger age are entitled to long-term disability benefits, there is no cost justification for denying such benefits altogether to employees who are disabled at older ages. Essentially, PRS would read Section 4F2 out of the statute. If all employee benefit plans are exempt as they maintain, then supplemental unemployment benefits, severance pay, prepaid legal services would all be exempt. None of these have any age-based cost justification. Now, this court today in Davis versus Michigan said that the statutory language cannot be examined in a vacuum. Words of a statute must be read in their context with a view to their place in the overall statutory scheme. Congress passed Section 4A1, which says that it shall be unlawful to discriminate in the terms and conditions of employment. And then they set up an exception, on the other hand, which says that it shall be lawful to discriminate in certain types of employee benefit plans. The EEOC regulations is a careful harmonizing of these two conflicting parts of the statute. It provides and it recognizes that Congress, when it passed a law in 1967, recognized that there were certain problems, that certain types of employee benefit plans were more expensive for older workers than for younger workers. And it intended that employers would be allowed to reduce the benefits to the extent that they did not cost more. And so this regulation balances.
Why didn't they say that? You have to admit that's a very, very clear way to say that, if that's what they had in mind. I mean, they could have said to observe the terms of a bona fide seniority system or any bona fide employee benefit plan where the discrimination is cost-based or something like that.
Justice Scalia, I will admit that this is a poorly drafted statute. I think that we have the statute.
If they meant to say what you say they meant to say, it's poorly drafted.
If you want what I think at the time they recognized there was a problem, and there is absolutely nothing in legislative history that indicates that they considered how to resolve the problem. Instead, they said, we expect the Secretary of Labor to write comprehensive regulations. They said that in 1967. They said it in the statute, and they said it in 1979 again. And this is exactly what has happened. The Department of Labor and later the EEOC, which have expertise in handling comprehensive employee benefit plans, wrote regulations which clearly provided balancing between discriminating against the employee unnecessarily and depriving or penalizing the employer who hires older workers. I believe that this is a harmonizing of the two statutes, the purposes of the Act, along with the purpose of the exemption.
May I ask another question about the language that I find very puzzling? It talks about a bona fide system which is not a subterfuge. Does that indicate that there are some bona fide systems which are subterfuges?
I don't have the answer to that, and it's troubled the courts. This is not the first time that
it's baffling to me.
Yes. It's a poorly written statute, and we all agree on that.
So you don't. What do you do about the language in McMahon that you don't need a business purpose or any economic justification?
I believe that McMahon is limited to involuntary retirement because it's clear that there was no cost-based justification in the intent of Congress when it was talking about permitting involuntary retirement, nor did the EEOC regulations or the ADA, the Department of Labor regulations. None of those had anything in there about a cost justification for involuntary retirement. The regulations for employee benefits back in 1969 did. I believe my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laughlin. Mr. Wright?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, it's important to keep in mind, as Mr. Laughlin just pointed out, that not only has Ohio failed to produce an age-related cost justification for its discrimination here, it's produced no justification whatsoever. Both the Department of Labor, which administered the Act until 1979, and the EEOC, which has administered it since, have agreed that Section 4F2 is not the wide-open authorization to discriminate that Ohio contends it is. Rather, the agencies have agreed that the statute requires employees to justify discrimination, usually by showing that it costs more to provide benefits to older employees.
Well, you don't now take the position that the employer's defense is absolutely limited to cost-based justifications?
Not in the sense of the life insurance example. If by age-related cost justification you mean that the term life insurance example that was very much on Congress's mind in 1967. No, we think it extends beyond that. But let me add that it has always been clear that it extends beyond that. If I may digress briefly into the legislative history to answer your question, the 1967 legislative history, and let me make clear that it was 1967, not 1978 that I'm talking about, there were clearly two problems on Congress's mind. One was benefits such as term life insurance, which do cost more to provide older employees than younger employees. Congress wanted to allow employers to spend the same amount on older employees, even though they would be discriminated against in that they would receive a lesser benefit. Also on Congress's mind, as is made clear by the colloquy between Senator Javits, drafted Section 4F2, and Senator Yarborough, who was the sponsor of the bill, Congress wanted to make clear that vesting periods were permissible. Now, vesting periods do not fall into the age-related cost justification exception like term life insurance.
Well, if you just look at the language of 4F2, together with the basic prohibitions of A1 and A2 of the Section 623, it looks more logical, doesn't it, to think that Congress just wanted to eliminate bona fide pension and benefit plans from the scope of the prohibitions of the Act.
We don't agree with that, Justice O'Connor. And while the language
certainly reads that way, unless there's a subterfuge.
Well, let me point out that the way Ohio reads it and the way you just paraphrased it, the statute would have ended at bona fide employee benefit plans. It does, of course, continue to say such as retirement, pension, or insurance plans, which are not a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act. Let me turn to the language of that language. The first part of that language, the such as a retirement, pension, or insurance plan, was emphasized by the Department of Labor in 1969 when it wrote the original regulations here. Like the Court of Appeals in Westinghouse, it thought that the thread common to the sorts of plans that Congress had listed is that the cost of providing benefits often rises as employees age. And it concluded that Congress wanted by that language to ensure that discrimination was justified in that circumstance. Now, I realize that they could have said it clear, but I would like to point out that Ohio reads that phrase out of the statute, gives it no meaning whatever.
That's true. I think there's another problem, too, Mr. Wright. The accepts don't make any sense if what they're talking about is only cost justified. I don't know how the failure to hire somebody, for it says, except that no such employee benefits plan shall exclude the failure to hire any individual. And then after the amendment, and no such seniority system shall require or permit the involuntary retirement. I don't know how either of those two could possibly ever be justified on cost benefit. So you wouldn't have to say except that. Can you think of how either one of those could be justified on a cost basis?
I think Congress just wanted to make absolutely clear that neither refusals to hire nor involuntary retirements were permissible. And it at least made that clear.
Why would they even worry about that if they thought they were enacting a cost justification thing? There's no way cost justification could have validated either of those.
That's correct, but remember that they also thought that they were allowing vesting periods. And in allowing vesting periods, perhaps the original administration bill had allowed involuntary retirement. I think the end of the statute just spells those things out, fortunately quite clearly. On the subterfuge language, let me just briefly say that discriminatory treatment of older employees that is not justified is a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act, because a purpose of the Act, which Ohio ignores, is to prohibit arbitrary discrimination against older employees. The Act does not only prohibit refusals to hire, and discrimination that is not justified is arbitrary. I think that it's clear that this is a post-Act statute. Before 1976, before the
Act plan.
Excuse me?
A post-Act plan.
Yes, that's what I meant. Before 1976, it is true that 60-year-olds could not apply for disability retirement in Ohio, but they weren't discriminated against as a result. They got the same amount that anyone else got.
They got the same amount. I don't understand what the purpose of the cutoff was. It seems kind of improbable to me.
The fact is, no one
dreamed it up, you think?
Well, there is also the fact that they, after age 60, weren't allowed to be on a recall. I think that was really the only difference before 1976.
Their benefits would be the same under the retirement plan or the disability plan. No reason to cut off the disability benefit. The Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Well, before 1976, it didn't matter. After 1976.
I'm just suggesting it seems improbable that it did not matter before 1976 if they had that cutoff. Because it was a totally purposeless.
It's undisputed here that in terms of amount of benefits, it didn't matter.
Well, except the benefit of being rehired.
That's
true. Saying once you're over 60, you can't come back, even if the collective bargaining agreement might have provided that people who are out for illness automatically come back. Why isn't that a significant discrimination?
Well, there was that discrimination against older employees here, and Mr. Loftman has made that argument that in fact, June Betts was involuntarily retired as a result. As the Court of Appeals stated, despite having every opportunity to do so, Ohio made no attempt at all to justify its discriminatory treatment of the plaintiff here. It has insisted all along that Section 4F2 authorizes any sort of age discrimination in the provision of employee benefits. The only exception, Ohio states at page 26 of its brief, is that a plan may not be conceived to avoid the statute's purpose of facilitating the employment of older workers. That's no limit at all, and it ignores the Act's prescription of arbitrary discrimination against older employees in the terms of employment.
I think they concede that if this plan were adopted today, it would be illegal. Don't they concede that?
No, they do not concede that.
No, they don't.
But, of course, that's correct, that if it were adopted today, it would be illegal. Contrary to Ohio, Congress did not intend to allow employers to discriminate at will in the provision of employee benefits. As Judge Posner stated in Carlin, Congress did not authorize employers to take away parking spaces or dental insurance or any other employee benefit for no good reason. Yet it would be permissible under Ohio's approach for an employer to arbitrarily cut off benefits to older employees. All we contend here is that Congress intended to outlaw such arbitrary discrimination. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Sutter, do you have rebuttal? You have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. 2 points right off the bat that I'd like to address. First, Justice Stevens, PERS is asserting that irrespective of whether it is a pre-existing plan, that it still satisfies the terms of the exemption. And the reason is that it is a bona fide employee benefit plan that is not designed to be a subterfuge to evade the purposes of the Act. The Act was first and foremost a mechanism for ensuring the employment of older workers. And certainly the Public Employees Retirement System of Ohio does not in any way interfere with the employment.
It also ensures them equal treatment after they get employed. Isn't there?
It ensures them.
You can't put them all the older people in a closet and say it's just because you're not being hired now.
No, Your Honor, and certainly PERS does not do that. It doesn't affect in any way the salary, the employment, the everyday sorts of things that come with working. All it does is it makes a distinction based on age in respect to employee benefit plans. And PERS freely admits that if it wasn't for the 4F2 exemption, there would be a problem for PERS in terms of satisfying the terms of the ADEA. But 4F2 is an exception. It was intended to permit discrimination in the area of employee benefit plans. Now, one of the big points that's been made here is that PERS didn't put on evidence. Well, as this Court might recognize, Ohio is one of those states that doesn't have legislative history. So we can't go back and figure out exactly what the General Assembly was thinking in 1933, even if we could find anybody who was around who was in the Assembly at that time. So we would urge the Court that for a public plan, it should go through the same kind of inquiry it would in analyzing the validity of any statute. It should look and see what sort of rational basis, what sort of legitimate basis did Ohio have. And it's not shrouded in mystery. Ohio created a retirement plan, and they started off by figuring out that people were going to have to work a certain number of years and be a certain age before they could retire. And then, as the district court discovered and states clearly in its opinion, then what Ohio did was it provided a benefit for an employee, a disabled employee who wasn't old enough to satisfy age and service. They gave him a benefit. Now, I don't know why that's arbitrary age discrimination. It wasn't intended to affect the employment of older workers. It wasn't intended to affect their salaries. It just does what 4F2 says. And I will tell you that in Ohio, this piece of legislation would be considered a model of clarity. We disagree with Mr. Loffman that this is a poorly designed statute. We think it says what it says. And he's right.
Tell us what can make it a subterfuge, then. What?
If, for instance, in the Carlin case, we had a plan there that certainly was designed to provide retirement benefits, but the circuit court unearthed the possibility that it was designed to force older workers to leave their jobs. That would be a subterfuge. Or if they reduced salaries, or they use it as a mechanism to reduce salaries. But I think one has to look at what was it designed to evade. It was designed to evade the restrictions on employment and on compensation, other than compensation offered through an employee benefit plan. And that's what PERS does. It's a retirement plan. And we are waiting for Congress to do what it's done in the past, to express its will in legislation. They came in 1974 and they passed ERISA to deal with the pension battle. It's Jacob Javits. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Sutter. The
Thank
case
you,
is submitted.
Chief.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.